Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige film. We're doing an animated movie today. Pixar Disney's 2009 Up is directed by Pete Docter, who also directed Monsters, Inc., Inside Out, and Soul. Screenplay written by Bob Peterson, who's also a credited writer on Finding Nemo, as well as Pete Docter, doing dual directing writing duties. He's a very talented Pixar writer who came up with the original story for Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., WALL-E, Inside Out, and Soul. It stars Ed Asner, famous curmudgeon, got a start on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He's played Santa Claus on Elf, passed away last year at the ripe old age of 91. My favorite Ed Asner is his appearance on The X-Files as a Christmas ghost, haunting Mulder and Scully with his wife. Okay. It's very delightful. Christopher Plummer, we know him as the guy from the girl, the guy from the girl with the dragon tattoo and Knives Out. And Jordan, the guy who kind of did this in a Simpsons episode and then peaced out of the industry and is a student. Well, we'll see if he does voice work in the future. Also stars the vocal talents of the screenplay writer, Bob Peterson. He is Doug the dog. Also stars Delroy Lindo as Beta, the second most menacing dog in the dog pack. You know, you've heard seen Delroy Lindo lately in The Five Bloods and The Harder They Fall. And of course, Pixar's Lucky Charm, John Ratzenberger. He's Cliff Clavin from Cheers. And he, I don't know if his streak is still alive, but up through, like, I think 2015, he was in every Pixar movie as some kind of cameo role. He got a start as the pig piggy bank, Mr. Pig in the Toy Story.
Sure.
This is interesting because most of the Pixar films, in fact, I guess I say all the Pixar films I've enjoyed as an adult person. Some of them I've had my son with me. This one, almost certainly not. 2009, I guess he was 3 years old. I might have brought him to this. But boy, this film packs an adult-sized wallop. If you've never seen this film, you are probably not prepared for the first 12 minutes. And I don't mean that in like a bad way. I mean that in like you're going to go through a goddamn experience. And it's going to set you up for the rest of this movie. And I think it's a delight. I think this movie is wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen this movie before, Jim? And if not, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I've seen it once before. And I loved it the first time I saw it. I loved it this time. I think it's amazing how much both fun and comedy and entertainment they pack into this hour and a half experience alongside the just truly powerful emotional stuff. We talked about this in The Green Mile recently, how powerful of an emotional film that is. And this packs a nearly similar punch as far as like how hard it hits you. And this entire time I'm thinking as we're going into this movie, can an animated movie be a prestige film? And I think this is one of the examples that says, yes, absolutely it can. The animation, whether it's 2D or 3D, is not just for kids. And I think it's interesting to me that Roger Ebert gave this like a 4-star review. This was a perfect movie to him. And he did not seem to have the same issues with this type of storytelling that he did with video games, even though they present very similarly in a lot of ways. Mm. It's just, you know, they're fundamentally different things. I get it. But yeah, I was super impressed with this. I definitely think it is a prestige movie. It has something for everybody in it. The kids can enjoy Doug the dog and Russell the kid and relate to the older people as like people in their lives. And then the adults come in and look at where Carl is in his life. And a lot of people have had similar experiences, you know, losing people that they're close to. And how it affected them, how it can change you as a person, and how to kind of grow and move beyond that and still live a life.
Yeah, I think it's the rare film where you have elderly people as the primary protagonist and antagonists. Have a kid that's not the precocious kid type, so he can kind of keep up with the adults. He's just a kid. You know, he does dumb shit. Mm-hmm. He is fairly sturdy, brave, and courageous, but you know, he's got some darkness going on in his storyline, and just the I don't know, the emotional arc of this movie and what it says about love and loss and dreams and pursuing them and at what cost and what you lose along the way. I think is definitely prestigious. This movie, it's funny because I wrote in my notes like how Studio Ghibli this is. Like, you know, this is, it's like, you know, Howl's Moving Castle. You got Carl's floating house, you know, the bright colors, the weirdness of the characters and the locations with the mundaneness of like the protagonist and whatnot. And I was gratified in the first paragraph of Roger Ebert's review when I read it. He immediately drew the exact same comparisons. Because it is this like high, what I guess you call it, grounded high fantasy.
Yeah, it's definitely a fantasy. Like none of the events in this movie could actually happen ever. But
yes,
the,
I would
the
say.
Emotional themes and the the subject matter is definitely grounded.
Yeah, the characters feel realer despite the situations that, that they find themselves in, the spectacular situations. And it is a fantasy because, like, you know, like there is a short film that's called The Rise and Fall of what is it? It's a Carl. Yeah, the Rise and Fall of Carl. I forget his last name. Fredrickson, Erickson. That's the last 20 minutes and it ends with him in a nursing home. And, you know, there is another option where he worked all night on a set of balloons and helium tanks and this movie happens and it's the better movie.
Oh,
but I remember because the first time I saw this, I was in a different phase of my life. I was, you know, had a as a father of three. I'd just gone through a divorce. I had lost a lot of friends and family in that process. And you know, the idea, it was a fresh wound, the idea of like not growing old together with someone and, you know, your dreams up to a certain point in life being given up. And I was wondering when I saw this on our schedule, I was like, I wonder if this is going to hit as hard in my mid 40s. And holy fuck. And if anything, the older I get, the more this movie resonates.
Yeah, totally.
And I saw that. This is like, you know, I had like every kid movie that came out between like 2006 and 2016 I have on Blu-ray because it's the law. And this is no exception. So I must have seen this movie 10 times, you know, in 2009 through 2010. But I haven't watched it a lot since then. And it just killed me like that for the opening 12 minutes killed me.
Yeah.
The kid, when he started telling a story about his dad, that killed me. You know, Doug's honestly, I was just a fucking wreck for this recording. The rejection of Doug killed me. The triumphant end killed me. The sitting at the curb at the end killed me. I was just a fucking blubbering mess on my couch this morning the entire time. It's a 5 megaton emotional package in a brightly colored kids film. What can you say?
It kind of takes you by surprise, I think, at the very beginning, because they start off so cute and so fun. And that's what contributes to, you know, the heartbreak in that first 12 minutes. By the time you get to the end of that sequence, it's gone to places you did not expect. Or certainly I didn't expect a Pixar film to go in the opening sequence.
Yeah, the opening sequence is so like Goonies / Sandlot, and then the movie just hits the hyperdrive, and then suddenly you arrive at grumpy old men.
Literally, though, there's like a montage of their entire lives for like a minute, and then you're suddenly like, wait, what just happened? Shit, they were going on a picnic. You almost can't believe what you're seeing at the end of that sequence.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like I read a lot about the many, many changes this movie came from Inception to from the inception of it to its writing, its production. And they arrived really quickly that like they need this intro to work, because if it doesn't, it's not going to work nearly as well. You have to carry the characters. And also, I think it does a good job at making, because Carl is a kind of curmudgeonly guy. And he's a grumpy old man and he's a bit of an asshole, but I would never, I don't think you could get through those first 12 minutes and be like, oh, this fucking old guy, no. You know, like he's got like ultimate moral license to be just kind of, to be dissatisfied and angry about and sad about how life has turned out for him.
Yeah. And they do a great job too, of just showing, you know, how he had so many dreams for what his life would be. And it's not just that he disappointed this person that he loves because he broke a promise. And I think unintentionally broke a promise to her.
Sure.
It's more about like, well, I had this dream too. You know, we had this dream together and we never accomplished it. And look at how the world has changed. Like, is this dream even possible anymore? I'm old. I mean, I wake up out of bed and I have to crack every bone in my body just to get started in the day. I don't think I could go up a hill. It might kill me like it did my wife. It's like
Ellie. Yeah.
It's about a lot more than just disappointing a loved one. It's about life and how it gets away from you and things happen. And if you just kind of sit there and say, well, oh, I'm angry about that, then the rest of your life is going to be just as miserable. You're going to miss out on the rest of it too.
Yeah. And when you get to the resolution to Ellie's dream arc late in the film, that also packed a wallop where it's like, you know, if you could go visit heaven or whatever and ask Ellie, you know, was she disappointed at the adventure that she went on in life? You know? And so Carl's like carrying baggage and weight that he doesn't even need to.
Right.
And like, there's a catharsis in that moment that almost unrealistically frees him. Like he no longer, he's found it's almost like the fountain of youth, like being able to, but there is something to that of like, you know, going from giving up on life and like, what is even the point to like, oh, there is another chapter and there's another reason to live. This is perhaps the grandchild that I never thought I could get. Then I can be a big part in this person's life and make a big, big impact. And
holding on to all the wrong things, right? I'm holding on to the regret of having not done something that I thought was what somebody else wanted to do, when it turns out that actually isn't at all what they wanted to do. What they wanted to do is live a life with me. And they did that, you know?
Right.
And holding on to this idea of like, we're going to keep this house in this place and it's always going to be pristine in my memory. That's not even what she wanted. She wanted a life that was evolving, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where he ends up. So I don't know. I really love it.
Movie looks amazing. I saw it on Disney Plus in 4K and, you know, it looks crisp and alive and vibrant in a way that only like these kind of 3D animations kind of can. And there's a couple things that are just like jaw dropping beautiful. Paradise Falls, of course, but just some little things like the way the light filters through the balloons. There's some early scenes where the balloons are coming in, they eclipse the sun and it just turns the world into a fucking kaleidoscope. And it's just like you just want to stand up and clap when you see a scene like that.
I'm super impressed by textures of things, like especially clothing. The amount of detail they're able to get, and this is back in 2009. I mean, don't forget, you know, this stuff was hard. Like if you look at the original Toy Story, which wasn't that long before this, it doesn't look as good as you remember. I guarantee it doesn't look as good as you remember.
No, God, no. The first Toy Story, the leap that we made from the 90s to the aughts to the 2010s. And I don't know, like I suppose we've gotten even better because if you watch like Sex, Love and Robots or Fuck Robots.
Yeah.
Fuck, Marry, Kill Robots. If you watch that on Netflix, like if you want to see the state of the art in animation right now, that's where it's at. But like this ain't far off, especially for the style it's going for. It's not going for that ultra realistic style. It's not trying to be Final Fantasy Spirits Within. Carl is a literal block of a man. You know, Russell is this roly-poly, weeble-wobble type of a thing. This emu, flamenco, bird of paradise. None of these things propose. The dog, like Doug the dog, is just this barrel with like two little tiny feet. It's got all that style and character and caricature. But they're also like, you know, Carl's able to be a man of action when he needs to be, you know. And you have to have such a rock solid understanding of anatomy to know how you can design a character like that and still have him move like because he's not built like a human, but he feels like he's got a human frame and skeleton. Like, I just think I'm always blown away. Like when I see another example is like in that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, when you see Kingpin and I was like, well, how the hell do you even pull that off?
Right.
And you can kind of only do it in animation.
No, and I love the attention to detail in some of those models. Like, there's no reason, and I wouldn't even notice if it wasn't there, there's no reason you need to give Carl stubble throughout, progressively longer stubble throughout this movie, but they do, and it makes it feel alive.
It does. Yeah, it really does. I didn't look like this Michael Giacchino, I think is how you pronounce Giacchino. Giacchino. He also almost has a Max Richter-esque job at that piano of, because I think this plays, if you rolled that 12-minute prologue as a silent film with no music at all, it would still work. Mm-hmm. But holy hell, the way he masters the tempo and key and slows things down and like really gets every bit of like of the both griefness and light of the grief and the light of this film, it is pretty crazy. I guess he just did Thor Love and Thunder. He's been doing some Spider-Man No Way Home. Damn, yeah, Rogue One.
Gotten pretty high profile. I want to say he did Lost.
He did the Incredibles too. Yeah. He's done some. That's probably the first guy. It's like composer I've seen in a while. I was like, I don't recognize that name, but my God, he's done so much stuff. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this film. Is there anything we want to talk more? And like, I imagine everyone's seen this film, but should we kind of tell people what it's about so we can get to the spoiler section?
Yeah, totally.
So this is the movie about the life of one Carl. He's a young explorer at heart. He meets the love of his life when he is in elementary school. And we get to see that whole full life lived in a 12-minute prologue that has been the subject of many a film school lesson. It's seen as like a textbook example of how you can do nonverbal storytelling. And he and his wife promise that they're going to go on this adventure and see this. What was it? What falls? I just said it. Heavenly Falls.
Paradise.
Amazon. Paradise Falls. They're going to visit Paradise Falls, which is in Venezuela. And they save up all their life. But things kept getting in the way. You know, car expenses, home repair. Carl breaks his leg or some shit like that. And they keep on using. And life keeps on going. And they get old and gray. And they finally get the money to go. And Ellie gets, his wife gets sick and dies. And this isn't the first 12 minutes of the film. This is not a spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
That is so you can understand that now Carl, who is being boxed out by a high rise development, he is the last man standing against this development. He's going to be pushed to a breaking point. And instead of meekly going quietly in that good night at a Shady Acres retirement home, he decides to use his lifelong experience as a balloon man. He's been a balloon vendor, and he gets every helium tank he can get a hold on and every latex balloon. He shoots that shit out his chimney, and he fucking goes airship mode. Will he make it to Paradise Falls? What hitchhikers will he pick up along the way? Will he finally accomplish him and his wife's dream? Or will he get waylaid one more time? There's a lot more to it. There's talking dogs. There's an emu family. There's must be a 130-year-old man that he'll meet that's even older than cranky old Carl. And it's a great experience. I think if you haven't seen it, you should definitely see it and make sure you get the tissue box, unless your heart's made of stone.
Sure.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Thank you.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move. Okay. I want to talk about how we talk a lot about tight scripts. This is a fucking tight script. There's not a minute wasted. Like, things that you will almost forget about by the time they're relevant. Like, the fact that they do this, like, in 90 seconds, establish this Muntz character, mm-hmm. who's, like, this, like, cross between Charles Lindbergh and Indiana Jones, who gets disgraced because he brought back some exotic bird, skeleton, and the scientists have doubted his bona fides. The bona fides? I forget. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. And he swears revenge and goes off to Paradise Falls, never to be seen. Like, I remember the first time I saw that, I completely forgot about that shit until you go to the dog cave and you find, and they do it all. Like, you know, he's doing these dog experiments in this newsreel. As soon as the dogs that talk showed up, you should have, like, put two and two together. But, and, like, you know, we've already talked about that prologue, man.
Yeah, I do have one other question about it. Why do you think they make Carl so inept as an adventurer in that prologue?
I don't know. I always got the idea that he was younger than Ellie. Like, maybe he's a year or two behind her, so she's just a little bit more developed. Okay. Or he. The other thing is, he is, you know, on The Wire, they say you're either a stoop kid or a street kid. Like, you either stay close to home or you kind of range a bit. Mm. Ellie seems like she's one step above a feral child.
Yeah.
She might be quasi-homed, and they really nail that when you see the wedding. And, like, on Ellie's side of the family, it looks like the Beverly Hillbillies reunion. Like, they're rooting tooting, just short of firing guns. And I relate. That's one side of my family. And then the other side is very waspy in button down and gray. And I think it's more of like, you know, Carl is the flower that finds purchase in rocky ground, and she is the Amazon sprawling vine complex that grew wild and the fertilizer of whatever she came from. I don't think you're supposed to understand that he's just inept. It's just that he was much more sheltered.
Sure. He's less equipped for these scenarios. And I think that maybe shows more what they choose to do, right? Like, she becomes like a zookeeper where she's working with the animals and the
Oh, is that what she is? I thought she was some kind of scoutmaster or something.
Is she? I thought they both worked at the zoo. He just ran the balloon stand.
Oh, you're
at the
right.
Zoo.
Okay, you're because I saw she had that pith helmet and the sash with the. I always thought she's like some kind of scout leader or something. But you're right. She's some. So they. Yeah. And he does seem like he's a little bit clumsier because, like, on the montage, he's the one that's constantly getting hurt and.
True. You know, I love how they paint a picture of them becoming more complete humans. Not just like, oh, they spent all this time together and got close. But, like, Carl, at the beginning of this movie, or at the beginning of this section of the movie, runs the balloon stand, but he's kind of fumbling, right? He's, like, trying to tie balloons, and he puts too many on his cart, and his cart starts to float away, and he has to jump and grab it, and he's like, oh, shit.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of that montage, he does the same thing, but without looking, he just kind of leans his elbow over on the cart that's floating away, because he knows...
Yeah.
The cart's going to float away, right? He's, like, created a whole life there. And just simple things like that that show how comfortable they've gotten in this life and how at ease they are with each other and their place. It kind of betrays I guess the realization that Carl has near the end of this movie right up front is just not as obvious as like a scrapbook full of memories that show she actually loved that life.
Yeah, it comes in handy later because he's like, there's many times where he at a glance, he looks at the balloons. It's like, yeah, we've got a couple more days, or like he loses the balloons and he starts to get nervous because he knows what it means, because he's like, you know, this master of buoyancy. The other thing is that it's such good writing and filmmaking, because they also like there's this all this joy of them getting married and starting their home together and getting their jobs. And then the next phase, everyone can tell you, in the American dream is to start having kids. And there's this 30-second downbeat where they're at, you know, they're getting the crib and the nursery together, getting ready. But then a minor key change. They're at the hospital. Doctor's explaining. She's weep, you know, it's all. And he goes out and kind of like, you know, says, well, what other adventures can we have? And they return to her scrapbook. And then that they dedicate the rest of their life. It's like, we're going to get to Paradise Falls. We're going to get to Paradise Falls. And when they and everything gets in the way, and they finally when they finally get to a place and they're old and he's going to surprise with these. God, I'm going to try to get through this without weeping. Jesus fucking Christ. I'm not trying to do this on a podcast on a Wednesday afternoon. There's this scene where he's going up the hill and she's following and she collapses. And then because they had no children, you have this boisterous wedding where there is huge family. But they contrast to the funeral where, as far as I can tell, no one shows up. Because they've outlived all of their friends and they don't have any children and all that. And it's just like they sell it to like Carl is alone. He has got nothing. And then he goes back to his house, which is now surrounded by empty lots. And then the next scene is going to be surrounded by he no longer has his gorgeous view. It's like all boxed in by this high rise shit. And again, they get to sell where like this cranky old man is going to violently assault somebody. And you're like, man, fuck it. Hashtag free Carl. I'm going to mount up and get like menace to society. My fucking ass. Like, can we get a GoFundMe for his legal defense? You're just totally on his side, you know, because
so unjust, right?
That guy wrecked him and Ellie's mailbox, man.
I know
that has her handprint on it.
And all he wanted was just them not to touch it.
Yeah.
And it's because like this is what he has left of the memory of his wife, right? The memory of his wife is this house. And it's throughout the movie, like it's the thing that he's dragging around with him, literally dragging around with him.
Yes.
Spending all of his effort to keep it by his side. And it's only when he can let that go that eventually he sees some kind of happiness and future in his life. And
yeah. I think
it's just so. I get angry at the beginning when they want to both pry that away from him, but also like just the way it happens, you know, and the reasons that it happens. It's like somebody else wants to exploit the area that he's staked out for his memory.
They really, those developers look like Agent Smith type villain, you know, like they are just almost alien. Like they don't have, there's no lines on their faces. There's like, it's, they're spooky and otherworldly.
As blocky and, as he is, they are the opposite, right? They're stretched like vertically.
Right. So then we are introduced to Russell, this wilderness explorer, and immediately you're wondering, like, why is this kid a Boy Scout? He's like, you know, chubby. He doesn't look like he enjoys the outdoors that much. But he's like, you know, wanting to be the senior. He's wanting to be an Eagle Scout, essentially. And there's, again, the movie's so fucking brilliant because from the very first scene, they give you the hint because he's like, I want to be a senior wilderness explorer and we'll be presented with my final patch at this thing. And all the dads come that pin the patch on and you don't even really notice it. It's just part of like the pattern he's doing a little kid. But like he establishes his motivation that he had this very close relationship with his father. There's some kind of fucking evil stepmom that's gotten in the way. To be honest, I don't fucking understand Russell's home life. Like I don't, it seemed like he's got a mom that's still there. His dad is doing some horseshit jabroni stuff where he's got his head turned by, I guess, a new woman. And I don't know, but he's completely neglecting his son. His son makes Eagle Scout. Is it possible his dad's dead? Because I'm trying to think of like what kind of fucking dad was this involved in his son's life? Just to the extent that he doesn't show up at his Eagle Scout ceremony.
Yeah. That's rough. Maybe.
Because, goddamn.
How do you justify telling your kid that, though?
I don't know.
Crazy.
I don't know.
clearly but yeah, he's like, not his life though. Yeah.
But Russell is kind of like the grandkid that he probably should have had to keep him tethered to, you know, to the current life. And he shows up. I mean, it's a hilarious scene where, you know, Carl thinks he's got rid of him by sending him on a literal snipe hunt. And, you know, when Carl, that there's this gorgeous scene where the guys are going to come to get him for Shady Acres. And he's like, fuck this, release the balloons. And it's great. It's this airship that he's rigged up. And it's got, he's got this like coffee grinding navigational system and stuff. And he goes to sit and he's like, I'm just going to go to Paradise Falls. And he hears a frantic knocking. And we know that he's like up in the air. Uh-huh. I love that reveal of the kid just like desperately clinging to the porch. Just like, can I please come in? And Carl slams the door and says no for like 5 seconds. Such a great beat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
And there's like, go ahead.
I was going to say their antagonism toward each other. Well, really, Carl's antagonism toward Russell through the entire movie is a pretty good source of comedy. And it pays off eventually.
And I love how, like, Russell's just a real kid, man. Like, when he gets invited in, he goes from, like, hyperventilating terror to, like, nosy curiosity in, like, 3.2 seconds. Mm-hmm. And it instantly starts annoying the piss out of. To the extent where, like, when Russell, another favorite part is when they're floating over and they're still not so far above land that you couldn't, like, maybe I could drop this kid off the top of a big apartment building. Yep. And so then they do the thing where he's lowering down on a rope. And I remember the night we saw that there was an audible gasp because holy fuck, Pixar just killed this kid. Yep. And it's just Carl saying, nah, that's not gonna work. So good. So good.
Yeah, it took me by surprise too. I haven't seen this movie in 10, 11, 12 years at this point. So yeah, I forgot about it. I was like, oh no. And then he's just back.
And I think that's what's so brilliant about this film is that, like, everyone's allowed to be the thing that they are. Like, Carl is a curmudgeonly old man. He never really changed. He changes his, like, frame and attitude, but he remains that. And all of his action and stuff is within that frame of what he can do as an old man. Like, even when he gets up to, like, the Bruce Willis Die Hard shit, his back's going to seize up and he's going to have to spit his dentures out to get the upper hand. But yeah, Russell's allowed to be a kid. Like, Russell is not the kid that's going to charge off and save the day. He's got a good heart. He's going to try. He's going to get captured. Mm-hmm. I like how the dogs are just dogs. That's some of the best stuff in the film is like, yeah, they're maybe slightly more intelligent and they've got a vocoder so you can understand them. But like, the fact that when it's one thing when Doug is like in the middle of a sentence, he's like squirrel. But like when the alpha, gamma and beta, like the menacing guard, like, you know, on task, they do the same shit. And that scene of Muntz doing the tour and like he's got all these Downton Abbey butler dogs. But like when they're pouring champagne, they're just slapping champagne everywhere and just dropping the thing in the bottle. And I also love the moment where Muntz decides that Carl and Russell are OK. And the dogs that were previously menacing are like, hooray. And they're just now they're acting like dogs. They're just like really excited. They want pets and they want love. I think that's great because other movies would take character's arc where, like, you know, Doug becomes unrealistically, I don't know, smart or whatever. But he's just a dog and Carl's just an old man and Russell is a little boy and they don't. They have an arc that they go through, but they don't change fundamentally who they are, you know?
No, it's an emotional arc, but they're still the ages and in the settings that they are. Yeah, it's really good. I have questions about the dogs and I don't know. I look at this movie and I go, okay, what was the time period for both animation and comedy and our society? And I don't know. I look at a couple of things and I kind of go, that's interesting. Like early on in the movie where, you know, you've got young Carl and young Ellie and she's talking about like what an exotic place South America is. Like, oh, I want to go to South America.
It's like America, but South.
Is that cutting edge comedy in 2009? I feel like it is. And it's so totally played out now.
Really? In what way?
I just don't think you make that joke and anybody laughs in 2022. Mm. But in 2009, that felt fresh and original.
Okay.
I don't know. That's one example. Another example of a thing that I think has aged out, the way they portray the dogs, and specifically like which breeds of dogs they choose to be evil. It's Rottweilers, it's Bulldogs, it's Dobermans, all of it. It's stereotyping dogs, right? It's surprising to me that is.
Are you asking for racial justice for Dobermans? I'm trying to calibrate how much of my will I want to put into this cause.
Dog lovers certainly do. I have a friend who owns two pit bulls and would probably be pretty pissed off if you were like
the velvet hippos. Pit bulls.
They're violent, evil dogs that just want to attack humans. They should all be put down. I feel like that would be bad. And they do that here. They say like, these dogs are all the bad dogs, right?
So they're definitely cops.
And then you got Lassie, the fucking golden retriever, the only one with a tail. Let's put that out there too. As
he's got tail privilege. Yeah, he's got tail privilege.
Yeah.
I mean, these dogs are cops for sure. I don't know if they're evil because like when Muntz calls and says these guys are friends, they're like, it's not like they're still like, oh, fuck these guys. And like, they're independently evil. They're just doing their jobs, man.
You can't use that as a defense.
No,
I was
but
just
like
doing my job. What?
I think for dogs we can. I actually think it's okay to be a little racist towards dogs. You know, I think it's fine. Like I'm not one that gets all up in arms about that kind of stuff. But
I'm not
either.
But I just noticed it, and it seemed to stick out in this movie.
Yeah. So I guess this is based on a real place called Tepu. That is in Venezuela, these like giant mountains with their tops ground off like mesas. There's actually if you go into Wikipedia and check this out, there's one Devil's Canyon that looks almost exactly. In fact, the film director, this doctor guy, he said that they went and toured this place for about a week to get like pictures and references and all that kind of stuff. It's like we had to actually scale back the craziness of the landscape because I don't think people would buy it as a real place on Earth if we actually just animated what we saw there. Damn. So like all of the crazy, like these all the different fractured rockscapes and these like stunning cliffs. And because I always thought it's like, well, how the hell do you get a waterfall at the top of one of those things? But I'm looking at one right now in Wikipedia where there's sure enough, there's a waterfall jutting out of this giant, sawed off mountain. So you get out of the gray city because like there's not a lot of color. Like there's a lot of the flashback stuff is kind of almost it's not, but it's got this kind of a sepia like aged look to it. And then in the city, like Carl is very old and gray and washed out. And the city is very steel grays and blues and muted colors and concrete. But then once those fucking balloons pop out and you get down to Paradise Falls, it's the exact opposite. Everything is just so much color and so much just vast scale and sweeping vistas and huge mammoth caves that can hold an airship. Man, there's so much imagination and just the set design and the geography.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
I want to talk about some more dog, because like I thought the dog humor is so well done. I like how they do the thing early on where Alpha's voice modulator gets damaged in his initial attempt to apprehend the Kevin, and he has this, you know, he's given this like arch evil dialogue, but it's in this chipmunk voice. It's a small mm-hmm. thing, but it's hilarious.
Yeah,
I love how the dogs are continually contextualizing things through their own experiences. Like Russell is wearing a uniform, so they refer to him as the tiny mailman. Mm-hmm. I think that's hilarious. I love that they're punished by being put in a cone of shame, which mm-hmm. is a veterinarian collar, and how much they don't like. It's like so ingrained that like accidentally Alpha gets put in a cone of shame at the end, and it's so debilitating to him that he will now respond to Doug as his leader. It's just, I don't know. I fucking love dogs, and this is a great. Boy, that's another thing that whipped my ass. I'm remembering because my dog Obi, who was this great blonde lab mix, died like 6 months before that I saw. And when like dumbass Doug showed up, he's essentially just like, you know, my dog Obi blown up, you know, a little bit fatter. Obi got pretty fat in his old age, but he's even fatter still. And I'm just like, oh my God, look at this guy. he's such sure. a good. Oh God, when Carl tells Doug he's a bad dog. Mm-hmm. It's so sad. And the movie's like, I had tears of joy when later, you know, Doug does good and like Carl's got the monkey of this house and these expectations off his back, and Doug's like, you know, can I come in? And Carl's like, well, sure you can, you're my dog, aren't you? And I'm your master. And I'm just like, oh my mm-hmm. God, it's so I'm so happy for Doug.
Well, if you want more of those characters, there's actually a series of animated shorts based on Carl and Doug called Doug Days over on Disney Plus. It's
interesting.
I watched the first episode of it. It's called Squirrel. It's fun.
So there's also a prequel, like a 6 or 7 minute prequel short about Doug's experience right before we meet him in the movie, where apparently the evil cop dog pack is giving him like the meaning busy work instead of like, you know, because he can't contribute to the real missions. I don't know why they have Doug, because you're right. All the other dogs are kind of like these big working security breeds. They're German Shepherds, they're Pit Bulls, they're Rottweilers, they're Doberman Pinschers. And then you've got just Doug. Mm-hmm. Like, did they make Doug as did Muntz make Doug as like a joke?
It's a good question. Why does he have Doug around? I don't know.
I want to talk about Christopher Plummer as Muntz, because he works so good as this kind of like really friendly guy who's just like tickled pink that a guy like Carl, who's a big fan of his, has come visited after all these years. And, you know, he's doing all this stuff. But the way he's, and he's so affable, but he also can turn menacing on a dime.
Yeah. Yeah, that turn where he shows them the helmets and the goggles and is like recounting all the adventurers who it's implied he murdered.
He murdered these people, Jim.
Yeah.
As he knocks their helmet off and you hear their head thunk on the floor, like the sound design on that, primo, by the way.
Yeah, that's and quite the heel turn there.
Oh, and this son of a bitch tries to set Carl's house on fire. And it's the one thing, because like throughout the film, like Ellie's picture almost falls and gets smashed.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl's always there to stop it. But this is the time where it actually happens. It falls, you hear it break. And it's like, there is nothing that can be done to this old man that will make me feel sorry for him for the rest of this movie. And, you know, they do... They kill him, right?
They kill him.
They do kill him, but they do it in a Disney way. The the classic Disney death, villain death, where it's a fall, and it's a fall precipitated by the bad guy's inability to call it quits. Yeah. Like, if he just like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to let this old man and boy go, he would still be alive on his airship hunting Kevins. But no, this fucker's got to try to make this jump from, you know, Carl's house, and it kills him. Yeah. So it's like, it's the perfect death. Like his own, he died by his own hubris, and also at the ripe old age of like 135.
Yeah, let's not forget.
I mean, how old is this guy?
Carl was a kid.
I'm not sure if he's old, but he's at least our 40. Age, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's gotta be 40.
At least 40. So if Carl has aged 60 years in that time, then yeah. This man's 100 at least.
This guy, yeah. If Carl's age 60, so let's say the age gap is 30 years. And, you know, Carl was 10 when he's watching his newsreels. And let's say he's 70 at the beginning of his adventure. That's got to make him 110 years. No, 100, at least 100 years old.
At least 100 years old. Yeah.
I wonder if we're supposed to believe that he's got some kind of advanced medical technology that's keeping him.
Maybe.
Because he is spry. Like he goes toe to toe with a man 30 years younger.
Oh, yeah. No, he's wielding a sword. It's yeah.
But yeah, he gets Kevin, and you know, this is the nadir of Carl. He drives away Russell. He calls Doug a bad dog, and he goes to set. Now he's done one good thing, which is getting his house to where Ellie wanted, and he's kind of restoring his house. I love the design of their chairs, by the way. They're just, you know, like Carl's is square and blocky, and Ellie's is kind of like curvy and tall and light. And because, you know, like you can't have a I guess Ellie's not a mom, but you can't have a mom age woman in Pixar without having her just a fucking ridiculous badonka.
Sure.
But when he goes and he finally looks at this memories, and I think he's going to add, I finally got us to this house. And he thought this book was empty this whole time because they never got to go on the adventure she wanted to go. But he keeps turning page after page of like all the stuff we saw. God, again, going to try to keep together. Aaron, he couldn't turn page after page of like this amazing life that they built together, despite the setbacks, despite and not just the financial ones. Like they clearly wanted to have kids and they couldn't.
Yeah. And it's clear in this sequence that this was her dream, right? This became her dream. It went from, I want to get to Paradise Falls and have an adventure to I'm having an adventure with this man in this life.
Yeah. Yeah. That last page where she scrawled sweet. And clearly, and I got the idea that she maybe finished this book in the hospital, like when she knew things were, you know, going to go bad and she wanted him to, and she wrote that like, you know, thanks for the adventure. I hope you have, you know, a new one or whatever. I hope you get to start your new one. God damn.
Yeah. And it's sad, you know, the fact he didn't realize this about her and he just was focused on his own failure to give her a life that he thought she wanted, when in actuality he had given her a life she did want. It's just sad that it took him so long to realize it, right? Because you know, it made him enjoy the life that they had together a little bit less. I'm sure he enjoyed it, but in the back of his mind, it was always,
Yeah.
God, like I it was a relative thing that she wants.
Especially since they came, they made it clear that he kept on, like, this was a promise that he felt like this is right. a promise that he let his wife down.
Yes.
You know, crossed his heart and swore multiple times and he didn't let it happen. And for her perspective, he'd given her everything that he possibly could have. Mm-hmm. And this frees him. This literally lightens his being. From this point on, he was no longer going to need his cane except for to kick mm-hmm. ass. And the house transforms with him. He has this idea of, because the house is like sagging and like barely able to get off the ground. Now he's like getting rid of all the burdens, like he's putting out yeah. all the furniture and all. And now when the ship flies, it's transformed. It's like nimble and fast and it can turn on the dime and almost like, you know, again, it's chasing a dirigible. It doesn't have to be an F-22 right. Raptor, but like it's invigorated and you know, it's stripped down. Like he doesn't have this complicated turning man. He's just got like two hands on the reins. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. Like I said, it's a little bit crazy that he is that spry, you know, like this
sure.
The love and affection he's got for this boy and Kevin and all that. And Doug has, but it works thematically so well, and mm-hmm. they never go too crazy because, again, he gets up to some Bruce Willis Die Hard shit, but his body is constantly betraying him. That fight sure. scene between the two old guys, oh my God, it's just so badass in this elderly way and still extremely funny, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the final, these are just dogs moment where, you know, in the middle, like, you know, they're in this tense situation. There's all these guard dogs around and they're on this crosswalks. And he's like, Doug, what are we going to do? And he goes and Doug's pulled one of his tennis balls off his rocker, his walker to start chewing on it. And that, all right, these are just dogs. So he just mm-hmm. jumps down in the middle of these fierce dogs. Is like, who wants the ball? And throws it. And they all yeah. go chasing it. It's so fucking good.
Yeah, it's great. My favorite moment, I think, in the entire movie is when Russell is hanging from the garden hose, which, boy, that garden hose does. There are two pieces of this house which are built like fucking tanks. It's the connection point for the balloons, which is his fireplace grate.
Yeah, that thing's a load-bearing member, man.
It really is. I don't know how they did that. Welded it right to the steel beams. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is this garden hose reel that's just kind of screwed into the side of his house. They hang from that. They swing from that. They drag the house around by that. When Russell's hanging from that and the house is going up next to the Zeppelin mm-hmm. and he hits the windshield and just for like 30 seconds squeaks his body across the windshield super slowly as Charles Muntz is watching.
Especially since he just says, where are you? And then, yeah, and he says, it's so funny.
The pacing there is so good because it's frantic and it's chaotic. Mm-hmm. And then they slow it down for that moment to just have that laugh. And it's so good.
Do you know one thing I've watched this probably the 13th time I've seen this movie. When the dogs at the end crash into each other, it's exactly the same moves that happens in the Death Star trench with Darth Vader and his escort.
I definitely recognize they were doing Star Wars homage because they're calling it like Gray Leader and Red yeah, 3 or something.
Yeah. yeah. And that's just like, it's like the exact moves, the first one that kind of flinches over and yep. hits the other one and then nice. They tremble and then it's exactly, and it's like, oh, such a great Star Wars homage.
And they call it out later. I think one of the marquees on a theater says Star Wars at some
probably.
Point.
Probably. I didn't see that one, but yeah, I can imagine. I mean, there's so many goddamn homages. I mean, clearly the Pixar crew loves Star Wars and, you know, who doesn't of that generation? Course. But there's also like really like I like the sadness but optimism they hit where he's got this airship, but he's also going to lose his house and it just goes off and he kind of has to say goodbye to his wife one last time. Mm-hmm. And I think they reveal this at the very end of the movie that house left to its own devices landed exactly at the spot that Carl and Ellie dreamed of, which yes. is the final thing that got me at the end of this goddamn movie.
Yeah.
Because it's just perfect, right?
It is.
And yeah. They got the coda of, you know, of course, he assisted the elderly. Mm-hmm. So Russell got his badge and there's panic of like, oh, my God, where's my dad? Where's my dad? Damn these wilderness explorers for not letting his mom do the dad duty on stage. Like they're gonna do like is this right. This kid is a fatherless boy. Is there a father in the house? Is there a single?
Is there a surrogate father? Maybe even.
Yes,
can we get any
yes.
man on this stage, please?
Can we have a person with testicles pin this to the? But the mother's sitting right there clapping, but she is of no
right.
But Carl's there to save the day and not only gives him his badge, but gives him the Ellie badge, which is the grape soda thing that she pinned on his mm-hmm. chest back when they met as children. Ah,
the only thing I'm not sure of, does he know the significance of that thing at all? Because he seems happy to get it. And it could just be like, I'm happy that this old man who I've come to love over the course of our adventure is pinning something on me. But it means something very specific to Carl, but not to Russell.
Yeah, because does he really talk about Ellie that much?
I don't think so. I don't think Russell has any clue who Ellie is.
Hmm. Yeah.
So he couldn't know the significance of this. It's the only like minor loose end flaw I see in this entire movie.
Yeah.
But like in that moment, it's not it's about both of them. Right. And I'm OK
right.
with it. Like giving this pin to him says it's the final nail in the regret coffin. I guess.
And that's
Carl.
That's, I think, an authentic kid experience, too, because I don't know how much stuff that my grandparents gave to me that I didn't recognize the value of as a kid and promptly lost.
Sure.
You know, I remember my yeah. granddad Kirkhoff sure. giving me this like 100-year-old folding pocket knife when I was 8. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is so fucking cool. I'm going to keep this forever. And 1 week later, I lost it in the woods.
God, damn.
You know, because like, you know, I put it in my side backpack pocket because that's where I'm going to need it. Right. And then, of course, I run and tumble and fall off shit and like, oh, my God. So like it also is like felt very true to life that like he's getting this, you know, high honor medal and he'll probably lose it next week.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else we want to talk about? I mean, geez,
what's the
this
future
is
for them. They're just going to go explore the world in an airship together. Right.
I guess like that's the bittersweet nature of the movie, because this is a relationship that's going to end sooner rather than later. You know, I don't know if he's got months or years, but it's not going to be decades that he's got left. But he's probably, I mean, the best case scenario is, I guess he gets him through high school. So he's got the surrogate father, grandfather figure. And, but you know, the other thing is, like, I think the movie tells you that Russell will be okay because Carl was. Carl didn't have the perfect life. Everything didn't get nicely arranged for him. He had a lot of loss and disappointment, bitterness, but he followed the dreams when he could, you know? And I guess that's another story, is that, like, is there ever an appropriate time to give up on a dream? Probably, because I think some dreams are dumb, are not as well thought out and attainable as others. Some may be not, you know, but like, yeah, like but on the other hand, like, I don't know if you want to do something, like, don't let setbacks and, you know, this, that, and the other. It's like you might have to put it on the shelf. You might have to start over and start saving from scratch. But it's the stuff that keeps you going. And like, I feel like this movie illustrates that well, because Carl, once he was deprived of his dream, had no life left to him. And mm-hmm. once he had another thing, you know, once he, you know, was animated either to get his house at Paradise Falls or later to, you know, be the man in Russell's life that he needs at the time, like, suddenly he's alive and he's got color and he's, you know, can get up in the morning without every one of his bones breaking. And I think that's a good story to tell people.
And by the same token, if there are legitimate reasons you can't pursue a dream, don't let that get you so down that you lose track of the things in your life that are positive, right?
Your wins and adventures that you do have.
Yeah. Because that's pretty easy to do. If you set your sights on something and you can't achieve it for one reason or another, getting down on it, on yourself about that is not productive, certainly.
What else do we have to say about Up?
I think that's about it. I guess Pixar as a company, I guess, is an interesting topic to touch on briefly. Like, they started off with such a bang, right? Like, every single movie they released was hot. And it tore you up, right? Like this movie does emotionally. Toy Story, boy, you can't even forget that. And they've done it 4 times now with Toy Story, many times with WALL-E and Ratatouille and all these high profile movies that people love. I haven't seen anything come out of them lately that I've been super interested in, but I know I'm kind of an exception. I don't watch a lot of animated movies.
And they're not as special as they used to be.
Of this caliber. You know? I agree. You have a lot more studios doing them. You have the DreamWorks and the Disneys all doing this 3D style that Pixar kind of pioneered.
Yeah.
So they feel less special. I don't know if there's too many Pixar movies coming out, but there are too many 3D animated movies to make them all feel special.
I will say they're still banging it because, like, I'm not sure because the line between Disney and Pixar is really blurred for me now. But like Encanto just came out a couple years ago and that Disney. Thing was extremely, extremely good and delivered emotional wallop. Coco. Disney. I think is that Disney yeah, too? Coco is another one that just fucking broke. So like, I haven't seen Soul or Inside Out, and I've heard they're both excellent. It's just I haven't, you know, for whatever reason we didn't. It's we don't usually do animated stuff for first run movies, and a lot of the movies I see are the ones we do to first run for. So I need to sit down my Disney Plus account. Now I'm probably getting into on Andor. I'll be spending more time on that platform, and maybe I can pick up some of these. Movies to check out because they're not ever too long. I mean, they're like an hour and a half. This like what, 96 minutes?
They've got to be designed for kids' attention spans. So
yeah, although like I said, I don't know. I wonder how squirmy kids get for the first 15 minutes of this film. You know, once the balloons come out,
but yeah.
But once the balloons come out and the dogs start talking, I think there's a lot for everyone to enjoy. But that first 12 minutes is kind of for the adults. I wonder how traumatic it is to see your mom and dad bawling at a movie that you're like, what's going on? I don't understand. So anyway, that's all I got to say about Up. How about you, Jim?
Yeah, same here.
So Up was a movie that was we let our executive producers each week. We submit them a slate of three candidate movies. This is the one that's selected to win. Next week, we're going to be considering the movie The Game. If you'd like to help us select which prestige or if we ever get some prestige coming out, maybe we'll get around to selecting some pulp movies. That'd be fun. If you'd like to help us select our slate of movies each week, an executive producer role on our Patreon. You can find out more about joining that at support.baldmove.com. We appreciate everyone that does support us. Until we're out with the game, we'll be back with the game. And maybe I'll figure out how to fucking conclude on these podcasts then, too. But until that time, I remain your shitty conclusion podcast host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim, who does not have the burden of doing podcast outros.
See ya.